This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Harold McGee, is an expert on the chemistry of foods and cooking. He's just revised his popular 1984 book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. And there's lots of new information in it. We asked him for some scientific tips on holiday cooking, starting with the turkey.
In a way, it's a no-win situation because it's this very large object that takes a while to cook. And it's made up of two very different kinds of meat, both on the same bird. But those two different kinds of meat really, to be done well, require different kinds of cooking. The breast is very delicate and doesn't have a lot of fat, doesn't have a lot of connective tissue. And so, in a way, the less you cook it, the better. You want to cook it until it's just done and no more. And that's to, say, 150 degrees or so. The legs, however, are tough meat. They've got lots of connective tissue, sinews and tendons and things like that. It's fattier, and it just isn't very good unless you cook it to 175 or 180 degrees. And yet they're both on the same bird and both in the same oven at the same time. How can you get those two different meats to cook in different ways? Usually what happens is, of course, that you cook until the leg meat is done, and that means that the breast meat is overdone. So one thing I've come up with is to kind of build in a temperature differential into the bird before you even put it in the oven. So you take the turkey out of the refrigerator the day that you're going to cook it, and a few hours before it's supposed to go into the oven, just let it sit on the countertop so that the legs can warm up, but put ice packs on the breast. So I did this the first time around with, you know, these athletic blue ice packs, which it turns out work pretty well. But, you know, then they're covered with turkey grease, and the athlete in the family isn't interested in using it anymore. So you can just take a plastic bag and crush some ice, fill the bag with ice, and then put it on top of the turkey's breast. And what that does is it keeps the breast at refrigerator temperature or even below that, while the legs get to warm up to about room temperature. And that's maybe a 15 or 20 degree differential, and that's about what you're looking for in the cooking process. So that's a way of helping out with that the different characteristics of the two different kinds of meat. All that having been said, however, there's no substitute for actually checking the progress of the cooking as you go, because even if you build in that 20 degree differential, if you leave the turkey in so that the breast meat just cooks beyond that point, then you end up with dry breast anyway. So you just have to check the temperature regularly.
Any good science tips about the typical side dishes, potatoes, sweet potatoes, stuffing?
Well, sweet potatoes are kind of interesting in that their sweetness depends a lot on how you cook them. Sweet potatoes develop their sweetness in large part during the course of cooking. They consist mainly of starch, the way ordinary potatoes do. But unlike ordinary potatoes, they have very active enzymes that break the starch down into sugars. And what happens in cooking is that when the temperature rises above, say, human body temperature, so it gets above 100, the potato cells become damaged. And this enzyme can then start to react kind of randomly and begin to break the starch in the cells down to sugars. The thing is that those enzymes are sensitive to temperature, and above about 170, 160, something like that, they just stop working. So if you maximize the amount of time that the potato, sweet potato, spends between, say, 100 degrees and 150 or 160, then you'll break more of the starch down into sugar, and you'll end up with a sweeter sweet potato. Put them in the oven and cook them slowly over the course of an hour or two, then they develop a much greater sweetness.
Is there any new information you learned during your research about chocolate?
People of all kinds have reported that they feel cravings for chocolate and suffer withdrawal symptoms if they can't have it. And so some very good experiments have been done to try to determine whether there's something in chocolate that is does have a kind of drug-like effect. And chocolate is very complicated stuff. There are thousands of different chemical compounds in there, including some that do seem to be very closely related, for example, to the active compound in marijuana, THC. So it was a very good question. What is the addictive capacity of chocolate? So some experiments were done that basically gave people either chocolate or something that seemed to be chocolate, but in fact was a placebo. It was an imitation product. And then also people were given the active portions of chocolate, but without the chance to taste it. So they were given capsules with chocolate inside, and they ate the capsules, didn't get any of the sensory satisfaction of chocolate, but were actually getting chocolate into their system. And what the scientists found was that the sensation of satisfaction and, you know, relieving of the craving and so on only came from the sensory experience of the chocolate itself. That the chemicals themselves didn't seem to have a direct effect on the body one way or the other. It was the experience of eating that made the difference. And so it seems to be that what's addictive about chocolate is not any particular chemical. It's chocolate. It's the eating of this wonderfully complicated, rich food.
It tastes good. this gets back to Christmas. A lot of people will be baking for Christmas. Tell us something about pies that we don't know.
Okay. The trick to making pies, you know, typical American pies, is that you have a filling that's very moist, made typically from fruit, and then a crust that you want to be dry and crisp. And again, it's getting back to the paradox of cooking the turkey. You've got both of these materials in the same dish, in the same oven at the same time, and you want the moist interior to stay moist, and you want the crust to get crusty. So what you have to do is kind of massage the cooking techniques to make that outcome more likely. Otherwise, what will happen is that the moisture of the filling will get into the crust and keep it soggy and prevent it from ever getting dry. There are various things that are important to that end. One of them is to minimize the amount of moisture in the dough with which you make the crust, and to keep the fat content of the crust good and high, because that does a couple of things. It helps dry out and crisp the crust very quickly, and it helps repel the moisture that's going to come from the filling. And then the other thing is to pre-cook the filling, to pre-concentrate it and drive off much of its moisture so that there isn't a lot of excess to penetrate into the crust and make it soggy.
Do you like to have a special meal on Christmas? And if so, what do you like to prepare or eat?
I like to prepare something other than turkey on Christmas.
Okay.
Because Thanksgiving was only a month ago, and we've probably been still eating it for a couple of weeks thereafter. So we usually make beef, and often with Yorkshire pudding, because that's pretty much the only time of year that we'll go to that kind of trouble. That's pretty much the tradition.
And have you been preparing that any differently since researching your new book?
I'm always trying different things. I would say, in fact, you know, in general, that I'm not that great a cook, and the reason for that is that I'm not really interested in finding a particular recipe that gives me the perfect prime rib, for example, and then simply reduplicating that every time I make the prime rib. I want to try different things to see what happens, and sometimes that means that it doesn't turn out so well. Something that I learned from a colleague of mine in England, Heston Blumenthal, is that if you it's very helpful, for example, to cook a very large piece of meat like a prime rib very slowly, because that gives you a much bigger window of time during which the meat is cooked through to the doneness that you want, but not overdone. And it also means that the meat is cooked more evenly throughout. The problem with cooking meat at a relatively low oven temperature is that the outside doesn't get as nice and brown as it would in a nice hot oven. And what Heston showed me is that you can actually take a torch and just very lightly torch the meat at the very beginning of the process. In fact, you don't even have to really see an effect from that torching. You just kind of pre-warm the surface. And then when you put that pre-treated roast into the oven and cook it at a low temperature so that the interior comes out moist and succulent, the outside does end up developing the kind of flavor that you would get in a higher temperature roasting.
So what do you use, like a blowtorch or something? What kind of torch?
Well, these days you can get these nice, cute little creme brulee torches. The problem with using one of those on a roast rather than creme brulee is that a roast has a huge surface area, and so it's a very slow and tedious process. So, yeah, I go to the hardware store and get a regular old blowtorch, and actually a heat gun works really well, too. You know, the kind of thing that you use for peeling paint off a wall, that does a good job as well. I've also tried a hair dryer. It doesn't get hot enough.
Is there a certain food or food preparation technique that you are investigating now and very caught up in?
No. I'm taking a break, to be honest with you. I am looking forward to my daughter loves chocolate, and ganache, you know, the filling for truffles is something that she and I are very interested in perfecting this year. And so we're going to be spending a lot of time over the holidays perfecting and eating a lot of ganache.
Is there anything particular you like to eat on New Year's Day, you know, out of a superstition that will bring you good luck, or this is the way you traditionally start off the new year?
Well, I love caviar. And caviar is something that it's hard to feel either good or affluent enough to eat these days. You know, the sturgeon are endangered in Central Europe, and it's very expensive. So what I like to do on New Year's Day is get all kinds of different fish eggs, maybe some farmed caviar from California, but then also you know, the kinds of salmon eggs that you see in sushi restaurants, and sea urchin and tobiko, the nice crunchy little eggs that you again find in Japanese restaurants, and just lots and lots of different kinds of eggs. And, you know, starting out the year with this object from the animal world out of which life springs and out of which life begins just seems like the right way to start the year.
That's really lovely. I'll probably take the more pedestrian route of an omelet. Harold McGee, happy holidays, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Harold McGee has written a new, revised, and updated edition of his book on food and cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. We'll hear more from him after the holidays.